Good afternoon, everybody.
Can you just can you say your name and say that you're present for the meeting?
Ben Galarno, present.
Peter Maury.
Right, I was saying, Scott Nagley again, I was saying that we have one agenda item that was also brought up and discussed in yesterday's adult subcommittee. And taking direction from that subcommittee, I'd like to make a motion that we go into executive session to have that discussion. And I need others to weigh in and say yes or no to that.
Blake Barney, I second that motion.
So I don't really know what that means.
I need your vote.
Oh, pardon me.
That's okay.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed? No opposed. Thank you.
So motion passes.
Motion.
Okay. Right. So if you can step out for just a few minutes, we'll come and get you when executive.
I'll be as fast as possible.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Ancillary adult subcommittee meeting yesterday is they left their first meeting with a little bit more clarity about some homework that people were supposed to do than I think we probably did from this room. That and the fact that we didn't have everybody was part of this in this room the last time. It would have made that harder to do. So I did come today with a copy of the Colorado standards for juveniles, which is an immensely comprehensive document. What I learned from yesterday's experience as it relates to the adult side of this process is that there are varying degrees of comprehensiveness that exist in different states, and the different states are doing things in worlds of ways that are very different than what we are accustomed to doing here in Arizona. That's not a commentary on good or bad, that's just a commentary on the degree to which, in some ways, I think, even though I think this board would never have come into existence if there weren't things that we needed to take a look at and to be focusing on, but from a process standpoint, I came away from yesterday's meeting feeling like, and perhaps in some ways, we're further down the road than some other places were. Now, whether or not that's the case with juveniles, I don't know. I mean, my research to try to find other documents from other states, like the Colorado one, that's, like I said, very, very comprehensive, I didn't find very much, but I think that's what I wanted, you know, bring up and talk about here today. And at the very minimum, all of us leave this room today with an understanding of kind of what we need to do individually to come back to this room and essentially mirror what took place in yesterday's adult subcommittee and to begin to start that process. And so just so everybody can hear it, Ben and Melanie, who didn't have the benefit of being part of that, everybody that's on the adult subcommittee, I think, picked a state and decided and was said that they would take the time to research that state, find what that state has in terms of written form around their sex offender management processes and functions, and come back to this meeting and talk about the pre-sentence side of the process as it relates to adults in those states that they did. Perhaps another thing that we should do here today is to begin to conceptualize what are the pieces of this process that we're trying to talk about and build here, and have some consensus about that, i.e. the pre-sentence side of things is part of that. But then there's the level of care discussions in terms of what levels of care do people get placed in. There's the supervision side of things, there's the treatment side of things. I'm just kind of rambling off the top of my head, but I'd like to hear, you know, people's thoughts about that. First, I guess let's stay with, do you think it's a good idea that we essentially mirror what people in the adult subcommittee did, and that is go out, pick a state, do some research on that state, come back and present to this group what you found out about the beginning process for juveniles in those respective states when a kid comes into the system. saves any one of us from having to do it all, and it helps us spread the task around. What are people's thoughts about that?
I think it's a good idea. I mean, excuse me, Peter Maury. I think it's good to find out what's out there so that we don't reinvent the wheel. I think probably, I don't know, 50 states, but we'll figure, choose a few, see if we can find some pattern of commonality that we like among them, and then maybe cannibalize that to build up it.
Melanie, if I don't get homework very often, but I thought I already had this homework. So I talked to Tom Leversley today for over an hour. I had that set up, especially specifically before we came today. So he is from Colorado. It is very comprehensive. I've had to work with him and present with him in the last couple of years anyway. So I took away some pretty good bullets from his already. I can follow up with just the pre-sentencing stuff. He did point me to, even just today, if I wanted to read all 20 of their principles, because they are pretty, I mean, he says ours aren't perfect, but they've been growing their board for years. They have a really good process that works with the schools, especially for juveniles, as well as not so much the DCS systems, but they don't seem to have as many issues with some of the dependent kids. Anyway, yeah, so I think it's a good idea. I already did it because I thought I had that homework last time. So I apologize.
No, yeah, that's good.
I didn't want to not come with it, but I thought I was assigned Colorado, so I had already kind of reached out to them.
So, I mean, I think what happened in yesterday's meeting is people who were on the adult subcommittee who had points of reference for certain states because they had either worked in them or gone to school in those places ended up picking those states and doing research about that. Does that make sense about how to perhaps move from here in that same way for us?
I would think so, because we not only have some familiarity with the state and the politics that go on there, but contacts. I think Blake has contacts in Idaho that he can talk to, and we're a melting pot.
For sure. And probably as far as the states that were picked in that discussion yesterday, we probably have more numbers than any of those states do. So it is going to be more comprehensive. It's going to be more cumbersome in some ways with what you just said, Peter, and with the increased numbers. What are your thoughts, Ben?
Yeah, no, I mean, that sounds good. And you know, I'm okay if you assign me a state, if you give me something to look at. I guess as long as we make sure we're all doing different states, different boards. And this would just, we would all be kind of looking at the same thing, the pre-sentence type procedures, not looking at different.
No, I think, well, now I'm back to the other thing that I threw out moments ago, and that is us really kind of, I think, perhaps in unison with the other committee too, but talking about, you know, what are the stages that we, how do we conceptualize this process, and how many phases or stages are there, and how do we want to language them? You know what I'm saying? I kind of did that a little bit ago, but that was just me spontaneously doing that. So I don't, you know, I'd like to hear other people's thoughts on that as well. And I say that not letting things like, I want us to try to just think about processes, and I want us to think about systems, if you will, and not, because I know I will get caught up in, well, juvenile court judges at the county level, and all the counties are going to end up, you know, no matter what we come up with and envision, there are going to be things like that are going to perhaps force us to have to look at things differently. So I don't want to get caught up in that initially. I suppose we can figure out how to move through some of that stuff when we have to move through some of that stuff.
Well, Peter Marty, I have a thought, and this is kind of born of my own ignorance, is I know parts of this system better than others, and I don't know if I know the whole thing in total. I don't know if we could find or if it would be a good idea to have a presentation of what this looks like moving through, so we know what we're dealing with, because we're essentially going to end up being responsible for the whole beast here in some way. And I sort of feel like the blind man and the elephant. I can tell you what the leg is, but hit me with a trunk and I have no idea what's going on.
So am I hearing you say it might be helpful if we tried to identify some people that are key players in some of the different systems of care,
mm-hmm.
Here in our state, and have them come and give us an overview of that, so that we all kind of have a roadmap to understanding how these systems mesh with each other, or how they're supposed to mesh with each other, and where they do and they don't?
I would think so, and I would actually propose we do that before we start diving into dissecting what we're looking for, because I think that would give us a deeper understanding of, okay, well, so here's how pre-sentence moves into trial and sentencing phase, moves into rehabilitation, housing, registration. Here, okay, when I look at, say, Oregon, okay, now I know what I'm looking for and how that system flows.
So Mel, do you have thoughts on, like, for example, from the DCS side of things, who could come and talk about the structure of DCS in the state of Arizona, not just Maricopa County, but the outlying counties too?
Oh, Melanie Opine, I could think about it. They're very structured at DCS, like many of the government agencies and big departments. You got a contract that doesn't know when you're licensed, it doesn't know when you're contracted, it doesn't know about the placements, it doesn't know about the case management. So I would have to see who'd be the best person to give a total list, you know, a total overview. But I know a lot of pieces from departments to say they don't know anything about the other department, mm-hmm. or refer you to somebody else at the different mm-hmm. department. So I can think about that off the top of my head. I don't have anybody in mind.
Yeah. And then there's obviously, you know, the juvenile probation side of things. And then there's the Department of Juvenile Corrections side of things, though that it's probably, in terms of numbers of kids, is far less than the kids that are in the juvenile probation system. Who am I missing with respect to key players when I articulate those?
Melanie Opine, when I'm talking to my contact that kind of helps create the Colorado board, he said that basically his guidelines, when they were all said and done, was their purview was over treatment providers, evaluators, and polygraph examiners. So he said they worked with the DCS systems, they worked with the probation departments, but they couldn't tell them, really, this is your guidelines. In other words, it was strong suggestions. It was, you know, it's kind of like ATSA, here's the guidelines, follow them if you will. But the purview and who had to follow it was really limited to those three. Now, I don't know where we want to go. I'd love it to be more, not you have to do this, but these are our guidelines and principles, and hopefully everybody's on board. And I think we have a little bit more robust. He had about 25 people on his board. We have 38 when we're all full. I think Jim had mentioned it in an email. So it really could cover a lot more. You know, we already have DCS involved, and at least adult probation is kind of involved in DPS. So maybe.
So here's a question to Victoria and Jenna. Who are the DPS people on the larger committee?
What do you mean by DPS people?
DCS, I meant.
Oh.
Department of Child Safety representative.
Anyway. Sat by somebody, but I didn't remember.
Perhaps that's the person to ask to come and talk about the structure of DCS.
As staff, we can certainly, if you tell us what you're looking for, we can certainly reach out and do that work for you. Could do that legwork and get what it is that you're asking for. But let me look and see.
And frankly, I don't know who at this point in time is the best contact at Department of Juvenile Corrections. I don't know. It used to be a lot more integrated into what I saw as the larger juvenile processes, but I don't have a clue anymore.
I do know general counsel for Milby Mountain.
Okay.
So Nicholas,
keep that in mind. I mean, I'd be happy to reach out to her for you if you want her to come in.
Nicholas Pulowski, who is with DCS, is a board member. It doesn't say what capacity he's at DCS, which is.
I don't have his title here.
look at emails and see if I can find that. I was looking to see if there was any other DCS representative. That was the only two. I can certainly look through emails and see if I have this.
You know, I mean, the juvenile probation side of things, I think we've already talked about who it seems to make sense to do that, and that's to ask Charlotte if she would be, you know, open to coming and, you know, give her a very specific, you know, sense for what we want her to talk about, so that the couple people on the board who, you know, or desire to see how things are connected in a more meaningful way could come away from that, from what she has to say. You know, I mean, she's Maricopa County, and I know, you know, from working with some of the folks in the rural counties, you know, they obviously have different needs and they have different ways of doing things. Some of which I think are sound and some of which I don't. And that could be said for Maricopa County too. So with that in mind, that, you know, she could probably talk about, you know, what she's, how she fits into the larger community of people that are in charge of the various probation departments throughout the state, and how they go about, you know, making decisions here in Maricopa County. But we have to recognize that smaller counties definitely have to do things differently.
Well, and I think, Peter Morey, I think an interesting question too would be, how do each one of these, I mean, you know, we get multiple people from different counties that give a brief presentation or even a one pager, how they see the overall picture, because they may see it differently too, which is going to develop into a different delivery system in different counties. And if our mandate is to try to put together uniform guidelines or try to find out, we're going to need to consider, you know, something that actually is going to be able to be implemented across the state.
I think the reality is, when we get to it, though, we will have to get to it, is there can be a structure that I think can be the structure that needs to guide the level of skill and the experience and the professional attributes of the people that need to play roles along the way in the process, but and perhaps even the kinds of things that need to be part of treatment, that are essential to treatment.
And how to get them, those resources, if they don't have them.
And a lot of times the outlying counties have to do what they got to do with their.
So, Lake Barney, I think one of the things that I'm struggling with all of this is, as the subcommittee, we're supposed to be doing the majority of the work, which obviously that's happening. But we've got to be able to present something to the larger board every month. And if we're, and I'm not opposed to people coming in presenting, but if we're putting things on the back burner, waiting for somebody to come and present so that we have a better understanding, it just pushes the, pushes things back further. So my proposition would be that, Melanie got information, I've got information on Idaho today, I can present that specific to the pre-sentence after my practice yesterday. And I think that any kind of progress is better than, well, we got to do this and this and this before we can make progress. So,
well, there's nothing that keeps us from having different kinds of things on the agenda for the same meeting. There's nothing that prevents us from doing that. The other thing, though, Blake, is because I mean, I've felt a little bit of what I think I hear you articulating, and that is, you know, we got to, in the end, some sort of product has to be arrived at. The problem is that I'm not sure that we can build a product until we've got enough cohesiveness and enough common knowledge and enough common ground amongst us at this level, first and foremost, and even in the larger board to be able to make things happen. And unfortunately, the only way I know in human experience for that to happen is for people to be in the same place at the same time, you know, beginning to grapple with some of the issues, you know what I mean? So, and the other thing is I haven't had anybody say to me that we've got deadlines to have X, Y, and Z. So I want us to be careful about, I don't want us to not do anything, obviously, but I don't want us to get caught up in, we've got deadlines to have something, you know, in place in a meaningful sort of way, or we're going to, I don't know, I think that's going to become problematic too.
Well, I, Peter Morey, I agree with both of you. And I'm kind of a different middle road, which I think you're both saying, and I'm just kind of bringing it together, is I don't think it's bad to necessarily have the basket of information, because we can always go back and revisit it. And we'll get a different and deeper understanding with the presentations. So I agree with Blake that I think probably having and gathering that information, but I also agree with you in that I don't think we want to say anything substantive until we have these presentations, understand what's going on, and can look back at that basket and say, okay, I get this now. I understand it at a different level. Let's pick that piece out and put it on your table. But that's something we want to figure out how to integrate into what we're putting together. So we have to gather all the information before we can really make a decision. I don't know that that has a deadline or that would be a self-imposed deadline. But I think that needs to be done before we can really begin to build something.
Yeah, I mean,
it's two informational baskets we need to bring together.
Melanie Opine, a couple naive questions. I think I know the answer to this one. Are we not allowed to email as a board to share information in between our meetings? I mean, I've got the link, he's got the link, we can talk about, you know, there could be a lot of stuff done in between the 2 hours we meet once a month. I don't know if that's, you know, if it's an encrypted email between the seven of us or something, if that would work. I think that would save a lot of time. Look over this. We know ahead of time when we're coming in that we can discuss things. I don't know how that's frowned upon. And when you were talking about some of these presentations, because I kind of see, you know, where we're both of you coming as well. Are you talking about in this group alone or in the bigger group as far as presenters, you know, the DCS or the probation or the victim? I mean, the victim should be part of the board anyway, but.
If I could jump in real fast, I guess I'm thinking, and you know, please correct me, those would be in this group alone, because I'm still waiting for the big group presentation on probation and how that happens, because I'm pretty clueless there.
Okay.
So I think that's got its own thing of overall system that I know I need to learn before we dive in. So I think the initial presentation, at least that I'm proposing for juveniles, happens here. And then we will take that back to the big group.
Like Barney, so I know that anything we do has to be public record. So we can't do encrypted emails. We can't send documents or records or any of that kind of stuff because it all has to be public record. I think it would be helpful and streamline the process. Unfortunately, we have the guidelines and policies that we have to follow with, you know, the public records aspect of it. However, yesterday in the adult subcommittee meeting, you know, I think three and a quarter presentations took place. And even if there's questions, and there were definitely questions, we still regurgitated the information that we had found. And I felt like I walked away with more information than I had when we started. So again, you know, my proposition is we just provide the information, and maybe it's just kind of a dump of information out there, and then we determine what we're going to do with that information. So,
Peter Morey, I would agree. I think if we could get, and I know there's always technical difficulties, but get it ahead of time. Like, I'm not pointing at you, Blake, for the squiggle lines in the from yesterday. So please don't take it that way. But I mean, if we get it ahead of time to even a couple of days, so that we can look at it and regurgitate it and have a fruitful discussion with the presentation, some questions to be able to ask.
And if you have material that you want to share with the subcommittee members, and you get that to me ahead of the agenda going out, we can attach that as background material, and we'll all have it a few days ahead of time to.
And then that's public knowledge. Yes, so yes. As long as it's
so whatever document you want to prepare and send to me, and you know, record. Disclosure, but that could be shared as part of the background material with the public so that they have access to those materials, and then you're prepared to discuss them.
But you're not prohibited, Melanie, as a member of this juvenile subcommittee, talking to Blake about the work of that we're doing, and then bringing your own notes to this meeting and talking about them in this forum. You're not prohibited from doing that.
I thought we'd already identified, maybe it was in a bigger meeting, like it was like Arizona, Idaho, not Arizona, Utah, Idaho, and Colorado were probably the most robust boards that we knew about, at least close to us, and not every state even has a board. We're obviously just barely getting ours. And so I'm not saying there can't be a few more that people know about, but those seem to be the most notable ones that we all do know about. So I'm kind of in the Blake category. If I don't want to go too long, too far with researching 25 states, as opposed to like, I wish we could all sit down for 4 hours and say, this is Colorado's. What do we like? What do we not like? Everybody mark it up. You know, what do you like from Idaho that's not? And what does Utah have that these guys don't? What do you hate about Utah? So, you know, I just feel like it could be a little more, again, I'm not trying to rush it, but I do just kind of have the same urgency of like, I don't want to reinvent the whole wheel. I don't want to come up with all of our own language. If we see stuff and can kind of pick and choose what's already out there, I think that sounds a lot more effective and streamlined than kind of coming up with all of our own stuff. That doesn't mean we can't think about what we want, but I'm pretty good at like looking at other people's and then deciding instead of free thought off in the wilderness.
Sure, Peter Moore, I agree with you, Melanie. I think you're kind of preaching to the choir here because we're saying the same thing. We don't want 50 states. I mean, I think a handful, but as I was saying with Blind Man and Elephant before, we got to know what we're looking at before we throw it all on the table, because I don't know that I'm speaking the same language you are, to be honest, when we get down at some of this stuff. So I think, we can run both tracks simultaneously, but I, for one, would really benefit from a big overview of what we already have before we start pulling anything out of the basket. Collect the basket, absolutely. It's out to make decisions on. I'm not comfortable with that.
I didn't necessarily mean, I'm Melanie, open decisions. I just thought if we kind of look at what those guys have, then there'd be things in Colorado's that I didn't even know about either. And then we know what we don't know.
True, but if I don't understand what they're actually being applied to, I don't know that I can effectively do that without a deeper understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think Scott Nagley, Peter, what I think I hear Peter saying, and I suspect, though it is speculation on my part, that there are a fair number of people who are sitting in the larger Arizona Sex Offender Management Board meetings who have a sliver of knowledge with respect to this larger issue, but also don't really know how it all fits together. And that's what I was trying to say when I was saying that we should be trying to do things along the way here in a meaningful sort of way and be committed to that. But there's a piece of this that's only going to take, it's only going to find traction and start to build momentum when the collective consciousness of the group is at a certain level of information and knowledge base. And with all due respect, I don't think it's there at this juncture that we could even begin to go back to the larger group with some ideas and proposals and decisions that we think make sense and not have a whole bunch of space to go through before we ever get to making a decision, because they're just not in the same place that we are with what we're talking about. So I'm going to be an advocate for us. Yes, something needs to be born from this process, but let's not be naive about the fact that we're going to experience a whole lot of barriers to doing that until we've got some collective consciousness that exists. We know that's true from any group that we've ever been involved in professionally. And a piece of that is safety. And right now you got 30-something professionals sitting in a room trying to gauge where everybody else is coming from and what they think is the right way to intervene with people who misbehave sexually. And if you lined them up in a continuum in the room, you'd have a continuum, that went from one end of the spectrum to the other. And we have to find a way to, I don't know, that's got to be acknowledged and tested. It's real. And that's all I was saying, you know, earlier. I'm not trying to put the brakes on anything. I mean, what I would advocate for is that if you have things that you think need to be on the agenda for this meeting, then get them into Jenna, you know, and we'll get them on this agenda, and we'll talk about them in this room. I mean, I think, you know, what I'm hearing is at a minimum, two things need to be on the agenda next time. Presentation of the front end of as many different states as we can do. Each of us, you know, trying to pick one and do that with it. And perhaps seeking to have, you know, somebody from DCS or somebody from juvenile probation, you know, come in and talk about their structure. I mean, if we did those two things, we would have accomplished a lot, I think. But I'm just talking and I tend to talk.
Peter Morey, I second that. And I think part of my soapbox is professing my own ignorance for what's going on.
Peter, I want you to hear me say I respect the hell out of that you say that out loud, because it then gave me an opportunity to say that I don't think you're the only one that's true for. And that doesn't mean that I hold collectively more information about all the systems that exist in Arizona than some other people do. But there certainly are people in this room and people in the larger room who do have a pretty good handle on the larger processes by virtue of what their work experiences have been up to this point. I've articulated some of the limitations of mine today, especially with respect to the Department of Juvenile Corrections. I used to know, and I knew I could call, you know, for a variety of issues, but I don't know at this point. And I think that speaks to the fact that that's the case, speaks to a lot of things. I think a piece of it's of how they've just been an outlier. They haven't really been part of this process for a while. And I don't know what that's about. And I'd like to figure out what that's about so that we can help them with their needs.
Peter Morey, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, subheading as we get farther down the road, you know, retention as well is always going to be a major factor in treatment of these individuals. Because if they're having therapists or probation officers or whatever turn over every other month, that's going to certainly affect treatment. So, and that's not an issue we take up today, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, brainstorming there.
Yeah. Like Barney, one of the things I'm also just kind of thinking about is each one of us is a professional, but we have different aspects of our expertise in the sense that Ben is going to have way more information on polygraphs than any of us. Scott, you're going to have more information on the evaluation side of things than any of us. Melanie, you're going to have more information on the housing aspect than any of us. Peter, you're going to have more information on the psychiatry aspect of all this and the cognitive level of functioning and everything else.
Public health.
And the public health thing. And then for me, you know, doing the one-on-one treatment with them, working through as many different things, doing family work. So collectively as a group, we should be able to help each other out and answer some of those questions. And the questions that nobody can answer, that's where we're like, all right, who's the expert that could come and inform all of us, because nobody knows, right? And I think that that's another way that we can continually move forward with the acknowledgement. We don't have a deadline, but the public has expectations for the board now, because it's taken quite a while to get put into place. And I think that they're unrealistic expectations, but they're expectations nonetheless. And
I don't even know what those expectations would be, quite frankly. I think that
unreal, that's what they are.
Well, they are, but they're not concretized. They're not articulated. They're not known.
Exactly.
Well, if I can just jump in, because I think Blake made a really good observation here that, you know, collectively, I think we're chosen to the subcommittee because of our various strengths to come up with a whole thing. But as Blake was saying, there's some things, you know, we each have our strengths, we each know things, we each don't know some things. And I think taking that one level deeper, if we don't know some things and look to find out who does know, if nobody knows, that could be something else that we need to patch in or seriously need to figure out a bridge for that could help things move along better, stay more cohesive.
So, Blake Barney, this is off topic, but I guess on topic. The agenda item, my understanding, number two, was discuss the findings, correct?
Yes.
So, if we're going to address agenda item number two, that would be Melanie going through her stuff and me going through my stuff.
And that's perfectly
you guys we can provide anything on Colorado that you have so that we are demonstrating, you know, some kind of subjective matter that we provided to the group instead of groupthink, which is great, but we're also providing information for all of us to benefit from. So I would just hope we can go through agenda item two, if that's okay.
We can't. We still have time to do that today, so.
Okay.
Either one of you can go first and the other can follow.
I think I'll start with just some of the notes I took in discussing with Tom Leversey, who's a pretty prominent person in the national arena. I haven't always agreed with Tom, but he's a helpful resource. He helps the AOC here in Arizona a lot. He's good friends with Joe Kelroy. They've been colleagues for a while, so he's been brought in. So I've known him for years, even in the Arizona setting. One of the things he pointed out before I even go over the guidelines really quick, and I didn't do the pre-sentence stuff. It was just, I'll read just the guidelines. And that, to Peter's point, is kind of like, oh, I don't even, like, take notes. Like, I don't even know what that means. I don't know what that is. The more we read kind of what they're doing, then we know what we don't know, because there may be stuff I'm like, oh, I never thought about that. So I think it's kind of good to just have an overview to begin with. But he says to making sure, because their board started off as adults, very adult driven, and they just had to put the brakes and say, anything you've said for adults is shall and will. The language should just be can or maybe. Like, basically, he said that for kids, it just had to be individual practice, that it's not. If you have a 10-year-old versus an 18-year-old, your treatment is completely different. Your policies are completely different. And we've always run into this. And it goes with adults with different IQs and different functioning levels. But just he said this is something he ran into. And we don't have to run into it because we're getting his feedback to begin with. But just a lot of the language that's just very concrete for juveniles, they just kind of referenced it to individual practice. That this is the recommendations. This is the guideline. But it doesn't have to be so, like, a 12-year-old doesn't have to follow this if it's not appropriate for the 12-year-old. That was, I thought, pretty, and it's the multidisciplinary team that decides the youth and the individual treatment. And we definitely go with that in my group home. We have adults, now we have extended jurisdiction, which is something new at probation that everybody should know about. We have 18-year-olds that just got extended on their probation, so they're no longer kicked out at 18 if they're on probation. But that means I've got 18-year-olds living with 12-year-olds in a house. ADHS licensing has okayed it, but if I have a 18-year-old put their hand on one of my 13-year-olds, I've gotten adults hitting a minor. So it causes a whole lot of issues. So
for a second, Melanie. Sure. Did y'all know about extended jurisdiction and it going into effect in Arizona a couple years ago? Yeah, so that's an important thing to be aware of. They could extend the juvenile jurisdiction to 19, right? Isn't it? And it has to be agreed on, Peter, from the lawyer standpoint, has to be agreed upon prior to their sentence. So this, I think, came into existence because they recognized that they were getting late-age juveniles and that they weren't going to have enough time with them in the juvenile system. They didn't want to transfer them to adult court because they recognized that might be overkill, for lack of a better word. And so this came into existence, and I've now seen 6 or 8 cases of it myself, and it does.
We have a lot in my DCS responses.
What you just said makes me want to call the table from legal and a mental
Then I probably shouldn't go on. You might not. It's been very complicated for us. And yet we want to help these kids that are getting charges.
Absolutely.
And
a half.
We have kids, we have probably 3 right now. And one of them, he took the extended jurisdiction despite that he was going to be charged. He was going to be registered as a sex offender. So he kind of had he still can be, but that was his choice. And we're not sure he thinks he made the right choice given some of his behaviors. He's a pretty high risk kid. So now we have an 18-year-old really high risk kid that we were trying to save him from registration, but yeah, now he's in our home. So again, individual treatment for kids, they're all going to be different, and goes for adults too, but needless to say that there needs to be a team involved. And then I kind of already mentioned the purview and who they're over, the providers, the evaluators, and the polygrapher that they do a lot more with education than we do. I've got a kid right as we speak that's been out of school 12 days because DCS, which would be a different department of DCS, does these BID meetings. Anybody familiar with those? Mm-hmm. Best interest determination. They did it several years ago, mostly for foster kids. Because if you have a foster kid that's bouncing around from different homes and they loved Dobson High and they want to go to Dobson High, then they don't want that kid to not go to Dobson High. So if you're going to be the next foster family, you've got to get him, whether it's 50 miles away, to Dobson High. Well, we ran into issues because our kids come and we're not about to take them to 17 different schools. It would be a crisis for my group home staff and my structure. So we tell them this is where they're going to go, and they fight us, and they have to have a BID. Even if the kid is saying this is where I want to go, it's where every other kid is going at this group home. We're 12 days in with this kid not having an education because DCS kind of puts the brakes. So even stuff like that, Colorado seems to have navigated. They have an education specialist on the table of their disciplinary teams when the kid first gets charged, and they're already involved. So you don't have to beg some DCS worker to not do the BID and stop him from 2 weeks. So I'm impressed with some of those things that we have not got there yet.
Sorry, I do. Victoria Waldner. I have court at 3. So I'll be available by phone if something comes up until 3 o'clock. But if it happens after 3, you need to put it on the next agenda.
Will do.
Okay. Yep. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then one of the last things that we just had in our discussion was, and I've run into this with the Arizona Office of the Courts. I contract with them. That's my biggest contract is probation kids. They have always had a stipulation that if you're going to work with they call it the JSAV, the juvenile sexually abusive youth, you're going to work with the SO population, you have to have 2 years of experience to be a therapist. To which I say, that means I have to steal from my people in town because I can't create a therapist myself out of people coming up and through my group home staff. Or interns, they have to already be a therapist to be a therapist, which has really got us in a lot of trouble. Or not trouble, but it's so been very, very difficult.
Melly, they've stopped you from being able to provide supervision for those people so that they could get to that requirement?
Supervision wasn't the issue. They had to have 2 years experience on their own of being a sex offender therapist before they could be a sex offender therapist. And I've had interns that have been with me 5 years sitting in groups and been an intern for a therapist. They said, nope, they need 2 years. So my back door has been, they've worked with the Mercy Care, with the access dependent youth and outpatient. And then once they've had a year of that, if they finally started counting the internship that they do for a year as a year of experience. And then with another year of doing access kids, not probation kids, which is funny that you have to distinguish between the two kids, even though they're the same kids, then they can finally be an AOC therapist. Now they are looking at this, but Colorado had the same issue. He said that at first, who can work with a kid of this population was quantitative, this many hours of practice, this much training, and they changed it because of the same kind of issues to a competency model. They have a pretty comprehensive model about assessment on how competent the therapist is. The supervisor helps. There's a learning plan. Basically, if somebody's great at what they do, they don't have to wait 4 years to be a therapist. They don't have to wait 2 years to be a therapist. They're going to have a supervisor anyway. So I already told Tom, since he's buddies with Joe, to be talking to him about this.
That's what I meant.
I think AOC's on to us. It's been a while since I've had to hire somebody, but it puts us in a pickle to not have somebody. So that was one of the things that they've learned the hard way of making it way more competency-based than just this many hours. Because you can have a horrible therapist that's got 4 years and left school, right?
So does that mean that they have some sort of assessment instrument that they're using?
For therapists. Okay. And I don't know if it's a class or a 12-hour course. I didn't get that far with him, but it might be in his big document for the board. It may be in there. Well, I haven't looked over all of it. So, and that way you're not losing. There's another thing where you don't lose active people. It reminded me of our first meeting, Blake, where we couldn't seem to define treatment provider, and it was because some people weren't actively with this population at the moment. And he says they try not to lose good people that they've had for decades that just want to work with general mental health or something else for the time being. Maybe they're just going to run a clinic. So they have something where they don't lose those people. They keep them active even if they're in their field, but they're not direct practice. There's still a way to keep them active with that certification. He didn't call it a certification, but with that, you know, basically with that title. Yeah, credential. Yeah. So those were some good things I thought that he kind of just threw out to me in the time that we had. He said, yeah, if you want to just go over the guiding principles, and then again, I need to make my own notes on this. I had already kind of looked over it, but didn't jot anything down. Let's see if I can see all this without my glasses. If you guys don't mind, I'm just going to read through these.
These are the 20 principles.
These are the 20 principles. The guiding purpose of the guiding principles is to establish the core foundation principles from which the standards and guidelines are created, provide guidance in the absence of a specific standard or guideline. Highest, because number one, highest priority of these standards and guidelines is to maximize community safety through the effective delivery of quality evaluation, treatment, and management of juveniles who commit sexual offenses. Number two, sexual offenses are traumatic and can have a devastating impact on the victims and victims' family. There's a big paragraph after each of these. I'm not going to read those. Number three, community safety and the rights and interests of victims and their families, as well as potential victims, require paramount attention when developing and implementing assessment, treatment, and supervision of juveniles who have committed sexual offenses. Number four, safety, protection, developmental growth, and the psychological well-being of victims and potential victims is a priority for the multidisciplinary team, MDT. Number five, offense-specific treatment must address all types of abusive behaviors and not just the legally defined delinquent behavior for which they are adjudicating. Six, treatment and supervision decisions should be informed by a comprehensive evaluation and ongoing assessments. Number seven, risk assessment of juveniles who have committed sexual offenses should be based on an empirically supported protocol. Number eight, a multidisciplinary team will be convened and is responsible for the evaluation, treatment, care, and supervision of juveniles who commit sexual offenses. Number nine, treatment and supervision decisions should be guided by available research and best practice. Number 10, treatment and supervision should be individualized and responsive based on the juvenile's risk and needs. Number 11, evaluation, ongoing assessment, treatment and supervision of juveniles who have committed sexual offenses should be non-discriminatory, humane, and bound by the professional code of ethics and law. Number 12, assessment of the degree of progress in treatment is based on the juvenile's application of relevant changes in their daily function. Number 13, treatment should be holistic and enhance overall health and protective factors. Number 14, assessment, treatment, and supervision should be viewed through an ecological framework of development. 15, family members, primary caregivers should be considered an integral part of evaluation, assessment, treatment, and supervision. 16, treatment and supervision decisions regarding juveniles who have committed sexual offenses should minimize caregiving disruption and maximize exposure to positive peer and adult role models. 17, a continuum of care for treatment and supervision options should be available and utilized as needed. 18, for juveniles who have been removed from the home, family reunification can only occur after a careful consideration of all potential risks. 19, juveniles shall not be labeled as if their sexual offending behavior defines them. 20, successful completion of treatment and supervision depends upon a juvenile's willingness and ability to cooperate. Accordingly, members of the MDT should employ practices designed to maximize the juvenile's participation and accountability. There was 21. So yeah, it's just an overview. It's nothing, you know, but it covers a lot of safety, a lot of supervision. It covers the victims. It covers clarification and reunification with families. It covers the team, just what I love to implement here in Arizona, just getting everybody involved, which is why we need to know about DCS and probation. I know a lot about it, but people don't, but absolutely we gotta bring them to the table, make sure they're involved, at least on the juvenile side. But any questions, I can send this link to Jenna. It's a good document. It's big. And he kept saying, it's not perfect, but I kept wanting to say, well, what don't you like? Just so we don't have to look at what, you know, and again, I might not, you know, take his, you know, I mean, I agree with his opinion, but, yeah. Only thing I would add is the polygraphs, but it's because I'm very partial. Ben's here and I don't want to, you know, leave him out, but they don't say anything about the polygraph being used. I think there's a proper way to use the polygraph. We've already kind of discussed this. Peter may not have been here last time, but I'm definitely hoping that would make it into our stuff that we end up writing for juveniles, because it's very helpful with the victim and the family.
I concur, and I don't know what the exact appropriate time for us to foster that discussion is, but we should not forget that needs to be something that we discuss.
He didn't put anything, or they didn't have anything there about the education. That's just part of their team. So I think there's a lot of little pieces that aren't mentioned in their guidelines. Those are, again, generic, not generic, but general overview guidelines. But yeah, the education, the DCS being part of it, and yeah, polygraphs. Those are the things I saw that were specifics that weren't mentioned that I would want to make sure somewhere are mentioned.
Sounds good. Blake?
Okay, so Blake Barney, I had practice yesterday, so I have made this very concise to the pre-sentence structure for juveniles in Idaho. And basically they start with evidence-based screening tools that assess risk, but they also are trying to determine the trauma for the offender themselves, because juveniles who offend are typically predisposed to some type of trauma themselves. So recognizing the trauma and as well as the needs for that juvenile. And then there's recommendations about supervision, treatment, the conditions specific to each offender. And so much like Colorado, it is individual based. It is not an umbrella like some systems tend to be. And if a polygraph is going to be used, it has to be agreed upon by the guardian or parent of the offender, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and overseen by a judge who makes that determination. So they can use them, but it is very well thought out and determined, you know, how valuable it's going to be for the pre-sentence process. This is circumvented for those who are charged as an adult, even though they're a juvenile, and that would be something that falls under their criminal rule 53. Which is a juvenile who commits a crime capable or commits a crime that was capable by an adult, and they have very specific guidelines to that. In that case, then they can use the polygraph as they would with an adult. There is a little bit of a discrepancy there, but that caveat's important. And then they do their pre-sentence investigation report. And they identify the social history of the perpetrator or of the offender, as well as the victim impact that their behavior had. And that all goes into the judge's decision. So it seems as though the offender is to identify what type of victim impact their behaviors had, and that will directly affect what kind of sentencing they might experience from the judge and go into that decision. And then, much like with the adults, any of their providers are certified by their board, and they do use that term certified. So the board certifies any provider that is providing any kind of evaluations. They actually certify the polygraphers as well. So these evaluators all have to be certified by the board. If they're not certified by the board, they're in Idaho not allowed to provide any kind of services. It doesn't say whether or not when they're in juvenile corrections, if they are receiving treatment. I'm assuming that they have some type of sex offender treatment when they're in juvenile corrections. But it doesn't specify specifically. The current evaluation requirements during the pre-sentence is based off of the most previous 1 year, and it's supposed to be updated for legal status and risk profile every year as appropriate. So I think that's interesting too, because here in Arizona, we do it like once, maybe. Ever. And they're doing it once a year to determine risk profile for the juveniles.
Scott Nagley, question. So am I hearing you correctly say that there is somebody assigned to that case who, after the youth has been in treatment for a year's time, they're going back and formally evaluating their risk at that moment in time, and that gets communicated in some way, in a structured way, to the court, I assume. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, so my understanding of it, and I can get additional clarification, but my understanding of it is from their pre-sentence evaluation, and then once they begin treatment. So again, if that's taking place when they're in the juvenile corrections, I'm assuming it still happens, but if they're in corrections and they're not receiving treatment, I would guess that their evaluations wouldn't happen until they are
post-release.
Yeah, post-release and like in treatment actively. And then once a year, they're doing evaluations. So their evaluations are to inform the sentencing, their treatment planning, commitment decisions, probation conditions, supervision planning, and any potential registry requirements. So again, this is all pre-sentence when they do this, but this is reevaluated on a yearly basis, as appropriate, it says. So my guess is in some rural counties, maybe they don't have the availability for once a year, but they try to get it within that time frame. Let's see. So anybody who's a juvenile has to have informed consent from the guardian, and all the tools, the professional assessments that are being done, have to be approved by the Idaho Sex Offender Management Board, which are all part of the tools and assessments used by certified evaluators and therapists. So.
Scott Nagley, can I ask another question?
Yeah.
I make the assumption that the evaluators are a mixed group of both master's level and doctoral level people, or maybe you don't know the answer to that.
Yes, they do have master's level as well as doctorate level that can be certified by the board. I didn't get into what the specifications are for their certification, but again, I can provide that information after a little bit deeper dive. But yes, they do have master's level and doctoral level. So the interesting thing that you're saying with the extensions, in Idaho, they can be extended up to age 21 to remain on juvenile probation. Not necessarily housing, right, but to stay on juvenile probation, they can be extended all the way to age 21, or they get committed to juvenile corrections up to age 21 rather than transferring to adult corrections facilities. So I thought that was interesting as well. And then, yeah, for the most part, that's all of the pre-sentence and the treatment aspect of it. But the thing I take away from it is their Sex Offender Management Board is kind of overseeing everything from the adult side and the juvenile side. The state, the courts are referring to the Sex Offender Management Board for most of their things. And it's been in place for just under 14 years now. And they have quite a bit of influence over like regulations, legislation, all of the providers that are providing have to be certified by the board. And their members, there's 22 members on their board. So I think that there's certainly things that we could take from Idaho's guidelines and their way of doing things right now and implemented into Arizona so that we can be better than any of the other states that have a management board right now. So.
Oh, yep, I might agree, Blake. And I do, I get excited because, I mean, Scott kind of has known me the longest, but I've been doing this 25, 30 years, and there's been so many people pop up to say they're doing this work and are not doing this work. And so many kids get, especially in the, I mean, I pick on DCS, but there's just these group homes that, or even some of the ADHS that, you know, my understanding is when I have a behavior health home, I have a licensed therapist that works with the kids in that behavior health therapeutic group home. but there's about four other group homes in town that do not have a therapist. So then I'm wondering why I have to pay for a full-time salaried person with benefits and they don't, and then they outsource it to an outpatient therapist. So that's more of a business owner complaint, but it just doesn't make sense. And there's so many inconsistencies. And I had a guy that had worked with me in a previous YDI actually years and years ago, and he called like, "Hey, I started my group home. What book do you use?" And you know, he ended up just bought a Pathways workbook and was just giving it to kids. We recently started working out of Canyon State. They've been taking out-of-state kids for years, giving them a worksheet every week, no therapist overseeing it, and they're getting QRTP money. Yeah. So it's, I try not to get, you know, I just do my own thing and that your karma and everything happens for a reason, but it'll be nice to have everybody consistently qualified. I don't want to be the only one in town. There's plenty of work.
Well, I think
I'm like, when I have empty beds and other people are not seeing kids or treating kids, you know?
And I think, Melanie, some of the things you're saying about concerns about unqualified people providing treatment or systems having kids in them that need treatment that are not really getting treatment. I've begun to become aware of some of the people that have gotten contracts with AOC to do psychosexual evaluations. And it used to be that we knew everybody and that people had kind of moved through some space and I get calls from the probation department in the little county I'm working in. Do you happen to know this person that are on AOC's list to provide psychosexual evaluation? But I'm like, I've never heard of them. Or, you know, I do my own quick search and find out that they've had their doctoral degree since 2024, and which means they probably never spent any time working with this population at all. They've been trained on how to do psychological evaluations and have decided that they're going to apply for an AOC contract to do psychosexual evaluations. And so I don't know if that's showing up in Maricopa County. I imagine some of the longstanding parties that did evaluations here in the county are gone, right? I mean, I can only think of Catherine that might still be around, right? Yeah. So, I mean, that's problematic too. When the people are making decisions at the front end of this thing, you make recommendations to the juvenile court. I mean, and respectfully, they can't possibly have enough depth of the knowledge to know whether a kid needs to be placed in what level of care. I got asked by an outlying county court to redo an evaluation because of the evaluation that the young man had done by the AOC's contracted provider was going to send him to residential care, and he by no means was neither risky enough or didn't have the capacity to benefit from outpatient treatment. I honestly didn't know how they got there. I didn't understand how they got there.
Melanie, but there's a lot of, education is definitely needed. We've had a kid that they continue to say he's in a psychiatric hospital at the moment, which we never take a kid straight from there because our kids are in the community. But they keep saying, you've got to take him. You're the next level of care. And so I have to break it down. There's outpatient, there's BHRF, there's BHIF, then there's a hospital. So you wanting to refer him back to me is not appropriate. BHIF, you know, these are just things that are simple things, but the whole team and the evaluator said needs least restrictive care. So he needs to go to New Turns Hospital, not a hospital. So it's lack of, but this is a doctor who's writing in a report to send them to me specifically.
They think you're a hospital.
Yeah. And I'm like, come take a look. We got, you know, doors aren't locked. They can walk out the door. So it is, it's just, there's a lot of, education.
Like Barney, I think one of the things that I've experienced through my 8 years of being in this specifically is there's multiple different models of treatment that are being provided. If somebody gets unsuccessfully discharged from one treatment place and goes to another, they may not be doing the same type of treatment. It may be completely different. There's a guy who comes to mind who lives on the west side, and he came to me specifically for private therapy, and he's an approved center doing therapy, and I brought up terms with him that people were learning on day one, and he'd never heard them, and he'd been there for 3 years.
Consent.
And consentment, the offense cycle, actually.
Yeah.
He did not know about the offense cycle. And I'm like, what is that? Okay, I'm confused here. But those kinds of things are a disservice to the community, because without the consistency, our guys are not getting the same kind of treatment, and it's not evidence-based treatment that is being provided across the board. So these guys go in and learn all about how to love themselves better and how to have a better self-esteem, but they don't learn anything about victim empathy. They've never even heard the term victim empathy. And one of the big things is to be able to build victim empathy and have remorse and understand accountability and everything else. It's not just about making yourself like yourself better so you make better decisions. That's great, but that's not the model that has been demonstrated to be effective. But that's the model that probably 25-30% of the guys are experiencing when they go to their quote unquote treatment. And the other side of that is plenty of people who are behavioral health techs, so they're PhDs, they have a bachelor's degree, or they have 4 years of experience with a high school diploma, are providing treatment because plenty of agencies are cutting corners and saving money and making money by having PhDs provide therapy, and they're not therapists. So I like that Idaho has, everybody is certified. If somebody is in violation of something or is being shady or whatever it is, the board will just say, you're no longer allowed to do this. And they'll say, you're done. We're not certifying you, and you cannot provide these services.
So the term they use is credentialed, though, right?
Certified in Idaho. I think credentialed is Colorado, but certified in Idaho.
Melanie, if I'm most of the people, and this is me, not you, to who you work with, like, are a lot of people not on probation? Or are these people that is their probation officer who's funding their treatment before they come to you, some of these agents?
If I may, this is going to be a task that Blake and I and Peter both have to be mindful of when we sit in this room versus being part of the adult thing. We have to remember we're talking about juveniles when we're sitting
and
in.
And I get that you're probably talking about adults, but I guess I'm just wondering in the adult world, just, you know, for me to know who's funding those people.
Yeah, self-paid mostly.
Yeah. So all the adults, unless they're getting vouchers from probation, are paid for these treatment groups every week, and it's $50 a week.
So are they court ordered though?
Yes.
So they're court ordered, but they can find their own therapist.
No, they can't.
They cannot.
Specific people.
He sought me out for mental health issues.
Okay.
And because I do what I do, and he was in
right
what he was in, we got into other things, and it was like very clear he was not getting, you know, good quality treatment.
But whoever he was seeing was on a list that was okay by
yes, probation. It was on the federal side, actually.
Okay.
But the BHTs and stuff like that, that's across the board. And yes, when I'm working with juveniles, I'm working with them in the pre-sentence, so they're not on probation yet. There's only one guy I have that's post, but he's like 24 now. So
right.
And he's an adult in every aspect of it when he was a juvenile offender. So I think that the concern is, if we're required to provide best treatment, are we providing best treatment? And in Idaho, they want best treatment. So they're saying, we're going to decide who can do that. And again, I'm guessing for them to be certified, there's some type of assessment or something they have to do to gain that certification that demonstrates, yes, we are doing what is in the best interest of everyone.
And another thought, Peter Morey, going with what Blake's saying, I agree with you completely, but I think another benefit out of that is that we would have updated lists with the court. So I know there's some of these providers that are on these lists, and I'm looking at them more from court side, trying to find an evaluator that could be dead 10 years. They're so qualified. So, you know, I think having a centralized sex offender management board, you know, handles the juvenile and adult certification for these things is a good idea. Keeping it updated, keeping it available to the courts as well as the offenders and some cases that don't speak.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is historically in Arizona, the Department of Child Safety or CPS previously in juvenile probation, that through their contracts with ASC, they have separate lists of people that they have that are doing assessment work, and separate lists sometimes of people who are doing treatment work. And consolidating this in some way and providing a structure to what that needs to consist of, and the kind of experiences that somebody needs to have had before they are eligible to be able to perform, you know, either an assessment task or a treatment task, I think is an important piece of what needs to come out of this room. Because then you don't have people just sliding out of their graduate school programs into what are really, really important pieces of this equation, especially if it's the assessment piece of the equation that allegedly is supposed to set the tone for everything that comes after that. It's huge.
Frankly, it's complicated stuff.
It is complicated stuff.
It's complex, I would say,
yeah,
in a lot of ways. And Ben, I don't want you to fall asleep over there. So one of the things that I mentioned earlier was they certify their polygraphers as well. And I think that maybe one of the hurdles for being able to do polygraphs on juveniles is having people like you who have had a lot of experience and done a lot of polygraphs with juveniles as, you know, certified to do this. And maybe there's five of you in the whole state, right? Not 18 different choices, and who knows how this guy is going to do it versus how Ben's going to do it versus how this other person's going to do it. That's very specific. This is what's expected. We know Ben can do that. We know John can do that. We know that Deborah's going to do that, you know, whatever. And that might make that hurdle a little bit easier to get over if we looked to have some kind of evaluation or assessment, certification, something through our board.
Yeah, Ben Galarno. Yeah, you're exactly right, Blake. You know, there's a bunch of problems with the polygraph and people doing them. One of the main problems with the polygraph is that people operate under this misconception that it's psychologically abusive and interrogative. And anybody, and the problem is a lot of people who made policy don't have any knowledge about how a polygraph actually works. You know, I would like somebody that knows about polygraph to explain where the psychologically traumatizing and abusive aspect of this is, because anybody that has ever worked with polygraph for a while is a supporter of polygraph, and they see the value of it. Not only is it valuable, it's extraordinary. And I know most of us here have lots of stories about the way the polygraph has just changed the course of treatment, supervision, evaluations. And to the point of getting certified, I think the critics, people that will say it's abusive or interrogative, I think we could kind of address those issues, even though I don't believe those to be true. And again, most of the people that I've talked to that say these things will admit they've never used polygraphs, they've never observed one, and they don't really have any idea about how they work. They've heard things, they've watched CSI, and this is what they're basing their opinions on. So creating some kind of a certification, I think, is a great idea. And I've had this idea for a while. And I think it could kind of, you know, address a lot of these issues. But the way a polygraph makes difference in evaluations is incredible. And I know Scott can speak to this, Blake, Melanie, Peter maybe can too. I'm not real familiar with your experience there or use of those, but they really are, in my opinion, after 23 years of doing these and thousands of juvenile polygraphs, that they are hands down the best tool that we have. I can say that it's no more traumatizing, abusive, interrogative than anything else we're doing, you know? And again, if people could look at a video or get real information about what we're doing, they would be hard pressed to say that there was something abusive or traumatizing. You know, I hope I'm going to have this opportunity to kind of present just a list of benefits from multiple, you know, different angles that these kids go through treatment that people aren't, you know, aware of. I think a lot of people that aren't familiar with it see it as it's an event. You go and you take a polygraph, and it's all about are you lying or telling the truth. But there's so many different benefits to this that people just aren't aware of. So I think one of my goals, and it should be one of our goals, is to educate people and give them a realistic idea about what a polygraph is. Then we can start from ground zero and build on that. But when you're saying that the polygraph is a guillotine, let's make policy. The only thing you're going to hear is policy based on what a guillotine can do and when we use it. So I think the certification thing is a great idea. And I think there needs to be a lot of education and people need to get a realistic and accurate look at what a polygraph is and how we do it. You know, everything from a lot of the post-test interviews we do with these guys, the juveniles, is something like, hey, you're having a problem with this question about having sexual contact with a family member. Do you have any idea why? And most of them very easily will say, yeah, I've been having sex with my sister. And it's literally that easy most of the time. But people have this idea that we're breaking out whips and bright lights and we're screaming and yelling and calling them liars. I don't think I've ever called any juvenile a liar or said I didn't believe them. There are interview techniques and very creative ways to get kids to talk where you can side with them and get that information. And it's not as difficult as one may think that it is. And I could go on and on and on for hours and provide multiple examples about these things, but I won't do that. But at some point, right, we'll get a chance to do this.
We do need to do that, Ben. This is Scott, obviously. We do need to do that, and we probably need to do that, frankly, perhaps both in this room and at the larger board meeting. Because until we get to talk about all the things that you've kind of danced around and hinted at and really vet them in a meaningful sort of way, you know, things have just been done for political expediency. They haven't been done for community safety, and they haven't been done for the protection of yet unknown but already existing victims. And the researchers around these issues, they want to talk about how there's no evidence whatsoever that polygraph reduces recidivism. And we can have a discussion about the fact that there's no research, period. And that's one way to have a conversation about it. But since when is recidivism the only thing that matters in these cases? What about already existing victims that we don't know about, that we will never know about unless we were to polygraph our clients? And then we're sticking kids back in homes where we knew about one victim, a sibling victim, but we didn't know about the other three. And the kid never had to talk about that. And those victims never got the honor and the respect that they need and deserve. And now you've put them back in there, and I never had a chance to say anything about it. You're right. We need to have this discussion.
Yeah. Let me just give a quick story. And this is very sort of, ordinary types of things that happen with polygraph. You hear it and you think it's some amazing thing, but this happens all the time with polygraph. And if you're familiar with it, you know it. Handful of years ago, juvenile put on sex offender probation. His parents didn't want him to receive treatment here in Arizona, so they found a treatment center in a different state, I think Utah. Cost a lot of money, you know, the best of the best therapists. And this kid went through treatment for about a year. He had one victim, so he said, and he went through his treatment program, and he was a star client there. And after about a year of going through treatment with his one victim and the team got together and decided that he was ready to be discharged and go back home to his family. They didn't use polygraph there. The PO called me and said, hey, this kid's set to be discharged, and he's coming home in about 2 weeks. But they don't use polygraphs there, and there's just something off, and I'd like to maybe do a polygraph. He just seems too perfect. You know, he's got the one victim, and I'd just like to do a sexual history polygraph. So I said, okay. He comes back, and he comes to Arizona about 2 weeks before he's supposed to come home to do the sexual history polygraph. He comes in with his mom and his dad and his two sisters, and they're talking about how excited they are to have the kid come back home. anyway, we go in, and I'm looking at the two sisters that are there, and they're not looking real happy about having Big Brother come home, right? So we go and we do the polygraph. Long story short, you know, we're done. I told him that he was having some issues with this question about, you know, sexual contact with anyone a couple years younger, not consenting. And I said, what's going on with this? And he said, well, he said, I've had sexual contact with both my sisters. I've actually sexually assaulted both of my sisters. So had a conversation with the parents, and parents were very upset. And they went from, you know, wanting him home that week to saying he's not ready to come home. The treatment center had a big, you know, red alert, three alarm fire meeting about how did we have these amazing therapists all agree that this kid was treated and he should be home, and we're sending him back home to his victims. I saw the kid a couple months later because he came back to Arizona, was put in treatment in Arizona. I said to him, I said, you know, you went through a year of treatment here, and, you know, you said you had one victim, you did great. Everyone said you were ready to come back home. And you know, they never questioned the one victim. I said, how did you get through all of this just saying you had one victim? He said, it's easy. You just lie. How are they going to know? And he looked at the polygraph instrument and said, unless you have one of these. And these kinds of things happen all the time. There was nothing abusive about it. There was nothing interrogative about it. But it had it not been for that PO sending him over for a sexual history polygraph, he would have went back home to live with his two sisters who were victims. And Lord knows what might have happened. You know, he might have saved him from going to, you know, prison. If he started offending again against the girls and got caught again, his life may have been worse. So it's not all about being mean to the offender. Sometimes we're helping him, and we're certainly helping the family, and we certainly help those little girls. And this is a reason I think it needs to be mandatory. And I think if people could really see how this works, the way we do it, and the benefits of it, that they would agree.
So Ben, I you know where I sit in relation to everything that I heard you say, so I don't need to echo that. But here's what I do want to say, because it was stimulated at the last part of what you said, and it goes something like this. The people who are anti-polygraph will then turn and they will say, well, those therapists were just not trained properly to facilitate disclosure, and they didn't develop enough of a therapeutic relationship with their client in the first place to get them to be honest about that stuff. And that's not what's going on here. I mean, I want to say that out loud to the group that's assembled here, and I will happily say that to the larger committee. What's going on is there are some people that, no matter what kind of a relationship we have with them, are not going to tell us some of this information. And I happen to think that I'm a pretty good therapist, but I recognize that in some cases with some kids, I'm not going to get to the bottom of the well unless I have the aid of your assistance. And you and I are doing that with some select cases in a small county in Arizona, and we've been doing it effectively for several years. Yes, we have to ask for input from the court and from the judge involved, but I think that we have a relationship with that court, and we have a relationship with the judges involved, and they know when we ask them for permission to do a polygraph on kid X for these reasons, we're asking for sound reasons, and we're not polygraphing every kid. And we can have a discussion about you know, where do we draw the line here? Do we need to polygraph every kid or not? And I'm certainly open to having that discussion. But my point is those who take the position that the therapist just didn't foster having the kind of meaningful relationship with their client, and had they done that, they would have gotten to this information. They don't know this population. They don't know these issues. That's where I sit in relation to this.
Scott, and I'm Peter Morey, I'm going to kind of echo on to what you said here, because I think you're bringing on a much larger issue and kind of circling back to something we touched on earlier, is that with court-mandated therapists, you may not fit. And frankly, therapists turn over in the public sector a lot. And so you just frankly don't have the time or the luxury to match the child or adult, I mean, either one, with a therapist who is going to get to the bottom of the well. So I really think polygraph is useful. I don't think it's an interrogation tool, but I think it's also a useful bridge to see what therapy is actually getting through. Because, yeah, you're right, there are talented therapists out there. And there are talented therapists out there who can't work with a specific individual because they just don't click. I mean, the quality is only as good as the relationship, or the quality of therapy is only as good as the relationship in a lot of cases. So I think it's good to know where these people are standing and if the therapy is taken.
Melanie O'Pine, I know we're almost out of time, but I can't not speak if we're talking about progress. And Peter, to your point, I mean, we've sat in a room with people who've been working with offenders, especially there was quite a few Canadians that I remember speaking, saying, you guys have just been using these, it's a crutch, you don't have the therapeutic skills, you don't have the relationship, and all we could say was, you have no idea what your clients have done. And one of my experiences, and I've got 50 stories like Ben, of kids that came to us having finished AGJC in record time and having finished YDI in record time when they didn't use a polygraph. And the truth is, not every kid doesn't want to talk, but to Scott's point, once your therapist asks you how many other victims you have and you say none, are they supposed to ask every time they sit down with you? Because it's really hard for our kids, we're talking about juveniles, and it may be the same for adults, to say, hey, remember when you asked me that 4 months ago? I have a different answer now. I want to tell you about my other four victims. So it's unreasonable to think that my kids are going to cough it up, and it's unreasonable to think a therapist is going to start a conversation with how many others. You know, they don't beat them up. Since the polygraphs have been gone, we've had to just kind of move on. But it's really hard for a kid to divulge information when they have already lied to your face. And we don't care if they lie, tell us later. But without the polygraph, they never see that opportunity. So it's, they kind of get stuck in their own little pigeonhole of, and I've always said that research should be done on how does it affect a kid to lie to your face and get out with a big watch and a big ceremony and a plaque. That can't be felt great either. I mean, you must feel more like a criminal than ever, knowing that you just snowed your whole treatment team saying there was three and there was 13 victims. So I don't think it's good for kids to be passed along and say it doesn't really matter. We know that a lot of them lie, and I feel like it's more detrimental to not have them tell the truth.
And though I'm not going to get hunkered down in the recidivism-only discussion around this, I do think that the absence of the polygraph in a good number of our juvenile cases is going to result in recidivism increases. We're just not going to know about it for a little while. And we won't even know about it unless somebody decides to take a good look at it. Because yesterday's discussion in our adult subcommittee was part of the discussion was about what are the recidivism rates in state X. And I don't think a good number of states have any idea what their recidivism rates are. So if we really want to know whether or not the absence of something from an equation is going to manifest itself later as a problem, then that requires us to examine whether or not there's a problem there. But I'm on record, and I will be on record again saying right now, that I think it's going to lead to increased recidivism, and I think it's only a matter of time before we see that. The kids are showing up in the adult court systems, and we would have to do some really intricate research to track some of this stuff, have access to FBI databases and all sorts of stuff, to do recidivism tracking of people who moved from Arizona and all that kind of stuff. But it can be done. And I think it's going to show up that way. I just believe that that's going to show up that way, the complete absence of polygraph as it relates to juveniles. And that's not fair to those juveniles, and that's not fair to those families or to the victims that they go on to create down the road. Enough said. I recognize the time. We've probably gone longer than we all anticipated we might today. Please, if you have agenda items for next time, including coming with other states to do a presentation about the upfront part of the process with, please do. If you think that this group could benefit from having somebody from DCS come talk to us, or somebody from juvenile probation coming to talk to us, I'm not opposed to that happening. And while I'm going to be mindful of the well-articulated desire on this of members of this subcommittee to have something come from this subcommittee, I'm not going to succumb to we have to race to the finish line either. I'm going to insist that we take the time to have the conversations that we need to have whatever comes out of this subcommittee be meaningful.
If I could, Peter Warrior, I'd just like to put forth, Scott, I would like to go on record of asking that we do have presentations. I don't know who specifically, but if we can think of somebody or specific people, even from the bigger board, to come in and give a presentation. I know we're supposed to, I think maybe Monday even, have a presentation from probation.
Maybe it's on the assessment.
On the community registrations assessment tool. So I can work with either Melanie or Jenna to try to get, or both, somebody from DCS, if it's not the person that's on our board, if they can help us identify who the person in the juvenile world would be.
If you could just tell me a little bit more about the topic specific that you want them to present on. Is it sentencing? Like, what do you want the, because you
I think I want somebody to come who can talk about how the DCS system seeks services for kids that become wards of the state. And so we can understand the structure that they have, where they're talking about kids in general, but they're talking also about these kids, and that they can come specifically.
You can ask Kiki Box, she's the head of placements. She's not a big fan of mine, but I can still ask her, because she's really the one that helps decide out of a committee who goes where. And it's not going to be licensing, it's not going to be contracts and oversight. It's going to be the people that decide. It might be a very robust conversation.
Yeah, and I'd kind of like to see just, you know, idealized or ideally how kids are to move through the system. So we kind of have an idea of what's supposed to happen, so we can kind of identify where it's broken and why.
Just kind of a general overview of the process. Jennifer, you can be in touch with me if you want. If the guy, the DCS assigned,
he's the victim services program manager.
Okay, so maybe he's more on the victim side, but if the offender side, Amy Fox is now in charge of the placement team.
Okay,
and they are the.
Mr. Galarno, any thoughts from afar?
No, so you know when Peter talked, it kind of dawned on me that the issue I'm having is this overwhelming idea of the whole process, and that I'm not familiar with everything. You know, I almost wish it was a map on the wall, you know, with the arrows that say intake. A kid comes in here, and based on the charges, he goes here, 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 and we kind of work our way down and you know, in little sections and that. I mean, I'm a polygraph examiner. I've been around for a while. What's that?
Oh, I was just saying, DCS kid doesn't look like a probation kid, and I think that's where we have where it gets
it's hard to make
that a probation kid would with a judge and a probation officer.
Yeah, hard to make recommendations until you have a good idea about how it's supposed to go, right? And I think once we have that framework, but I think really kind of taking it one section at a time, having the presenters is great. This is the way it's supposed to look. This is the way it looks now. What can we do? It all sounds pretty good. I think presentations will be very helpful.
Yeah, and should in the grand scheme of things, it force the leadership from different entities to have to work together to come up with a plan, then I wouldn't lose a whole bunch of sleep about that either. So,
second that.
I can touch base with Amy from DCS, who wouldn't be relevant for the bigger picture, I assume, for the big meeting. And then I can talk to Charlotte, who's also just juveniles. I assume that we want those people just in here, not necessarily the bigger
presentation. I think so. At least
Tammy, on the other hand, I've already kind of been touching base with, and she wants to know more, of course. But I'd still love to see her on the board as one of the advocates.
Well, I'm clear about the fact that you and I could meet with Tammy and talk to her. So
I think she'd be okay. I'm just saying I'd actually prefer her be on the board if there's still a victim.
Yes, so please send contact
information. She wants to get a call afterwards and tell her what it would entail, but I will try to.
That's your job.
But I can talk to both Amy and Charlotte. Do we want them on the same day? If I tell them half an hour?
Okay. Sure.
I'll try to set that up for next month. Okay.
And then you just let me know if you need any help. If that
doesn't work out, or do you need
to reach out? And I'm sorry.
We'll be meeting on Monday, so we should definitely touch base with Nick.
Okay, with Nicholas.
And I'm operating under the belief that we can continue to have this room to meet in for this subcommittee, yes?
Yes, we have it reserved.
Not for the next month.
Okay.
The next month is ADOA.
The question.
Yeah.
That's right.
The next month.
Okay, so it's the last, where we have the last big meeting?
No.
No, it'd be somewhere else. That's part of the reason I'm asking, because a bit of this has already gone on, so.
Yeah.
Please, like, do whatever you can to accentuate the change on there, because I know myself and perhaps others too will be locked into, I know when my meeting is and I know where it's at.
Find my calendar with the right address. Yeah, this is the ADOA building, 100 North 15th Avenue. We can put a map in.
I couldn't find that list again on the website. I tried to find it yesterday, the complete list for the rest of the year. It was only showing up. Is that the whole committee or the?
We have all of them posted though, so.
For the entirety of the year?
Uh-huh.
Well, then.
Yeah, and it's, actually should have made it really pretty for you guys. I'm on the wrong one here. I'll let you do it. I don't have my mouse. I have trouble without my mouse. Yeah, that's why I was just gonna go back.
Yes, yeah. So just, excuse yourself and.
Do you want to adjourn and?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Scott Nagley, making a recommendation that we adjourn the meeting at 3:26.
Second that motion.
Is that an all in favor? All in favor, say aye.
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 Thank you, brother.
So right here, you go to, this is the UPS page, and then you go to boards and councils, and then you go to sex offender management board. And then.